And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Today, a look at Googling and how that affects us, the way we think and the way we take in information and see the world. Looking ahead for the remainder of the morning show schedule for this week, tomorrow we preview tomorrow night's American Experience documentary called Klansville, USA, which looks at the reemergence, the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan and the state of North Carolina during the 1960s. It was a surprising development because North Carolina was widely viewed as one of the most liberal and progressively minded of the southern states. Nevertheless, that is where the Ku Klux Klan took hold in a really dramatic fashion, and a superb documentary about that airs tomorrow night. We'll be previewing it on tomorrow's morning show. Wednesday, I look forward to Art Sears' visit to offer analysis of current events. And, of course, there is so much to talk about, particularly the terrorist attacks in France and so on. We'll have that conversation on Wednesday. On Thursday, it is the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. And on Friday, I look forward to reconnecting with Mark Cushman, the author of a series of really interesting books that Star Trek fans have very much been devouring, called These Are the Voyages, which takes a methodical look at each and every episode of the original series of Star Trek. We'll talk with him about the third and final book in the series, which of course focuses on the third season of the show. Again, support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Today's morning show was recorded. On today's morning show here on WGTD, our topic is Google, both as a noun referring to one of the world's most famous and successful companies, and also Google as a verb referring to the Googling of information, something which all of us do on the Internet and almost certainly without thinking very much about it. Siva Vaidyanathan teaches media studies at the University of Virginia, and he indeed has thought a lot about and studied the process of Googling for information and the way in which it changes how we view ourselves and others and the world and the way in which we process information. His book about the topic is The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry, published by the University of California Press. I wonder if you could tell us about the academic field of media studies, which is what you teach at the University of Virginia. First of all, how long has that field existed, and how drastically has its sort of curricular embrace changed over the last few years in terms of what it is you study and teach?
Yeah, those are two very good questions. The study of media has existed in other areas of intellectual life and academic life for a number of decades. Starting in the 1950s, actually in the 1930s, we start seeing sociologists and psychologists pay a lot of attention to the effects of media on us. You can imagine the rise of propaganda as a tool and a weapon in World War I, and then subsequently in World War II, or the rise of, you know, the rise of fascism and Nazism. Spurred a lot of people to pay a lot of attention to the ways that this new phenomenon, mass media, with radio and television and film, could sway people in exciting ways and sometimes alarming ways. And so the study of media is about a century old, but the study of media as a discrete area of the university is much younger. It's really only a few decades old. There were, you know, communication departments that sprung up in many of the Big Ten schools in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, sort of building on rhetoric and paying a lot of attention to these questions of propaganda, questions of effect. And so, you know, the Big Ten schools, University of Wisconsin included, really led the way in studying media. They don't always call their departments media studies. They often call their departments things like communication arts or journalism and mass communication, as University of Wisconsin-Madison has both those departments. My particular department at the University of Virginia is explicitly called media studies to show that the field has really matured as a distinct field, and we are explicitly interdisciplinary. We have people who are trained as sociologists, trained as political scientists. I'm trained as a historian, we have other people who are trained in the history of film and the study of film, and another who's trained in the history of journalism. So, you know, we take a very holistic approach to how different media industries and media practices help us make meaning, how they affect us, and how we affect media expressions right back. And so it's a really exciting time to study this. It's a really exciting time to take an account of, you know, all of the massive changes that have happened in the past decade, as we've seen companies like Google rise and really shake up the very notion of what it means to mediate communication. You know, you can imagine the internet with its interactivity and its really strong feedback systems, you know, really pushing out a lot of the old assumptions about how media would work to, you know, to brainwash us or push us in a certain direction. I mean, now it's really hard to accept that as gospel. We have so much more to work with now, as we human beings have been so completely mediated.
Mm. I am just taking a guess here, looking at your photograph on the book jacket, that you are significantly younger than I am. I'm about 50 years old.
I'm not significantly younger. I'm 44.
Oh,
but thank you for the compliment.
Well, you wear 44 very well. Well, then you and I are pretty much of the same generation then, who remember the world not only without Google, but remember the world without the internet. Remember the world without people owning their own computers.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could just say a word about what it's like for you to teach young people who, in a sense, do not remember a world like that, a world without the internet or personal computing.
Sure.
I mean, I should think, I mean, if I had to do what you do, I don't know how I would begin to help them even understand the world without everything that we now so much take for granted.
Yeah, I'm constantly reminding them how new this stuff is. And I teach a big class called Introduction to Digital Media, and part of my job is to make them understand that the devices and the practices that they engage with and that you and I engage with now so consistently are not natural and are not a given, and they may in fact be very different in 5 years because they were very different 5 years ago when none of us were on Facebook, for instance, right? So you know, it's trying to convince them that just because their entire high school and college career has seemed to be based on, you know, the smartphone and the interactive web and Facebook, does not mean that the next 5 years will be, does not mean that it was 5 years earlier than that. And so I do a lot of, I mean, they can see that I'm not as old as their parents usually, but I'm, you know, not that much younger. And yet I make it a point to show almost autobiographically the extent to which computers have worked their ways into my life and been an important part of the U.S. economy, an important part of creativity for an intense 40-year period. And I focus a lot on the history of computing. I make it clear how important computers were in the 1960s, you know, with the rise of government databases and corporate databases and so forth. And so we do quite a bit from a historical point of view. You know, basically, I'm trying to, it's a lot like trying to teach oceanography to a fish, right? You're trying to convince the fish that this is not all there is, you know, that in fact, the water all around you is weird and worthy of study, and not just part of the atmosphere, you know, or I guess that it is part of the atmosphere, but that makes it worth studying in and of itself. And what I find is it's not that hard to get them to suspend that. And maybe because I have the privilege of teaching at the University of Virginia, where we have a lot of deeply curious and committed students. But I think that what we really see here is, you know, for the same reason that students really don't have a mental block about studying the Vietnam War or the Cold War, it just takes a little bit of guidance. My job as a professor is to give them that bridge to that new perspective on understanding. So, you know, we have students who study Latin and we have students who study media studies, and they're both different ways of framing the world. And you know, to me, it's really exciting, largely because it's different every time I teach it. I teach it every spring semester, and I have to change the books every spring semester. The issues in the world are different, but still, I'm trying to convince them of some of the, or teach them some of the basic principles of what makes digital media special, and why we're in this time of tremendous flux, anxiety, and opportunity.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Siva Vaidyanathan, who is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia and the author of a book which we are about to discuss called The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. As, of course, the title suggests, it is examining the pervasive presence of Google on the World Wide Web. In fact, at one point you say that Google is coming close to being in a sense, thought of interchangeably with the World Wide Web itself. I mean, not just a big player in it, but it nearly seems to be one and the same, at least in the minds of many people. At the beginning of the introduction, you say, in the beginning, the World Wide Web was an intimidating collection, interlinked yet unindexed. Clutter and confusion reigned. I am remembering some of my first encounters with this then new thing called the Internet, and I remember naively going into a Barnes & Noble and asking if you couldn't purchase something sort of like a phone book, like the Yellow Pages, that would have, you know, lay out, you know, all the different websites you could go to. And, of course, even then, well, the Internet was not in its infancy, but very early on. But even then, it was an absolutely preposterous possibility. I mean, you couldn't house every website in a single bound book. It was a ludicrous notion. And yet that just, I think, in a way, is another means of saying what you're saying about what the Internet felt like to many of us sort of riding its waves in those first days.
No, exactly. You know, like we sensed, those of us who were playing around on the early web sensed tremendous possibility, but tremendous frustration as well, you know. And you remember in the early web, some of the prevailing, and by that I mean, 1995 through 2000, some of the prevailing concerns were really legitimate. We were not convinced that we should engage in commerce over this medium. We were not convinced that it was safe to type in our credit card numbers. We were not convinced that we should use it for banking. We were not convinced that major reliable media sources would be willing to engage with this medium and spread their content so far and you know, invigorate conversations in interesting ways and let people do what we do now, which is, you know, quote and remix and link and like on the web. And you know, so the web had this tremendous potential for those 5 years, and we really weren't sure what to make of it. And there were a lot of concerted efforts by small companies, entrepreneurial companies, to try to solve a lot of these problems, to solve the reliability problem, to solve the confidence problem, to solve the encryption problem, right, for just basic credit card security. And in Google's case, to make sense of it all, to give us a sense that the World Wide Web was not going to be a jungle in which we would get lost. It would actually be less of a web and more of a well that we could dip into. And maybe now it's the World Wide Well because of Google. Google lets us start someplace and look for a variety of sources about a particular issue or question or good or service, and then basically drill down the list that Google provides us. And so it's a very different way of experiencing the web than we did in the 90s when it was more webby. We used to have to go link to link to link. We might start with Yahoo and its carefully edited list of recommended sites. And if we're looking for things about baseball, we might go from Yahoo to its preferred baseball sites and then follow the hyperlinks on those pages to three or four more, and we might get lost along the way. And that was very webby. It was, you know, moving node to node.
But, right, or you know, Tarzan jumping from vine to vine.
Exactly, right. And just, you know, so again, if you're as smart as Tarzan, great. You can, you know, if you're born in the jungle, you can make that work. But for most of us, that was not an efficient way to get around. And certainly not a good way to do things like depend on pages and judge pages. So what we've done is we've let Google do that for us. We have... You know, Google came up with the folks who founded Google, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, came up with a brilliant way of assigning rough relative value to pages based on the subjects you were searching for. So, you know, based on the number of other pages that link to a page, those count as votes, as affirmative votes for the value of a page. What they say inside Google is relevance of a page. To a particular search, and other things matter, like the number of times that a search term appears on a page, or terms that are related to that term appear on a page, and then there are 100 other factors that go into why one page would come up above another. But that simple insight that this hyperlink is a really powerful potential vote of affirmation. It's not always. We often link to pages we hate, but you know, maybe 9 times out of 10 people link because they want to give someone access to a page they appreciate. You know, that has helped us make sense of the web, and it's really put Google in a position that is really enviable, because it engendered trust almost immediately, and not the sort of trust that we articulated. It just feels right when we use Google. You know, my wife told me in the process of writing this book, my wife came up with this insight at a moment of sort of frustration, or wasn't really saying what I wanted to say about how Google works in our lives. And my wife said, you know, the thing is, Google reads our minds. It seems to read our minds. It seems to know what we mean when we don't even know how to express what we mean. And I said, exactly, right? It's often my wife who gives me the good stuff, right? And helps me do these things, right? So, you know, exactly, that's the thing. It's like Google has figured out this method by crunching a tremendous amount of data about the world and about the web and about us as individuals, and sort of triangulating and guessing what we really are after. And most of the time, Google gets it right, which is why we have very few, like, comical search results. You know, we don't share, hey, look at this hilarious search result I got on Google. You know, you would think that if Google were getting stuff horribly wrong all the time, you know, we'd be sharing those things the way that I don't know if you're on Facebook, but sometimes the ads that Facebook presents to us are just so off, so tone deaf, that they're pretty hilarious. But you know, that doesn't happen with Google, and that the very fact that Google is able to achieve this level of trust without having to advertise and sort of fake it makes it a really special phenomenon. And so I set out in this book to try to examine the nature of that trust and that faith that we put into it, and I hope also to undermine it in a sense, because I don't think it's necessarily healthy to use something, even something so good and powerful, so blindly. I wanted people to understand how Google works and use it more critically.
I want to take a moment to probe back into history, and it's so funny to hear you talking about the early history here, being 1995 to 2000.
Way back in the 20th century.
Yes, yeah. Right, as though we're talking about the Renaissance or something. But I remember, and I'm sure many of our listeners do, although only if you're of a certain age, that back, for instance, in the mid to late 90s, when you wanted to go surfing the web, at least at a place like Carthage College where I teach, when you clicked on search the web, you would see on the screen the icons for maybe 20 different search engines, right, each one on one of those colorful little rectangular bars. Right. And I, for one, had very little sense of how each of those was different from another. And sometimes if you were making some kind of serious search, you might click on several of them, and it was really hard to know how that search would vary depending on which search engine you were using. And what's so interesting, too, is that, I mean, until I read the word Alta Vista in your book, I couldn't think of a single name for any of those search engines that once upon a time were very important to a lot of us. Can you just remind us about that landscape and then how Google managed to assert itself and essentially wipe out just about all of those from existence?
Yeah. Well, you know, so early search was exciting, intellectually exciting, and chaotic. And that's why there were so many small companies trying to do it. And, you know, part of the assumption of the early days of the web was that you didn't need much. You needed a web server and good connectivity. You needed some smart people who, you know, might be Stanford dropouts and, you know, but you know, really were into the code and would be willing to work long hours for the beauty of doing it in the hopes of creating a winner. And you never know if something popped, if you got big venture capital money, if you had an IPO down the line, you could become an instant millionaire. And so it was a really heady time. And so you have all of these different firms popping up, names like Dogpile and Northern Lights and Alta Vista and Excite, and they all had they all started with different basic concepts of search, and over time, as the search community sort of learned from each other, they started to converge around different ideas. Google had an advantage being late. You know, we usually think of the early adopter, I'm sorry, the first mover company being having the big advantage. But Google had the advantage of actually coming in a little bit late. 1998 is when Google's first service went up online. It had the advantage of actually being a part of the Stanford University network, which was, you know, a pretty resilient network that was unlikely to go down. And it was done by a couple of grad students at Stanford. And by coming into the game late, they could learn from others' mistakes. They could realize some basic things. Like, for instance, you know, back in 1998, nobody had broadband, right? Nobody had cable modems. So everyone was dialing in. We were running the internet through our phone lines sporadically during the day. We were not on for hours at a time. We would have to select discrete times to dial in and wait for the modem to connect, and connect at a terrifically slow rate.
I remember, you know, the days when 28,000 seemed like the speed of light. I mean, that was great when you signed in and it was 28,000.
And it was good enough for text, right? But images would sometimes take 2-3 minutes to load, and forget about sound or video, right? So Google figured out that it could simplify its interface. It would just have this one box that would be the search box, and it would say Google above it. So your brand would be there, and your search box would be there, and it would present the results in split seconds in simple text, right? There'd be no cartoons, no images, no dancing frogs, nothing to distract you. There wouldn't be multiple boxes with different sources of information the way that Yahoo organized its front page. It wouldn't be colorful. And by limiting these aesthetic elements, by making it stoic in a sense, Google was able to achieve fast loading time, fast results. It was able to do what it did cheaper and more dependably. The service went down last, right? And all of those things seemed to matter almost instantly. It also, oddly, gave Google a veneer of trustworthiness because you could never trust the people screaming at you on the web in those days, right? There were just so many loud attempts at grabbing your attention and pop-up ads that would pop behind the page you were on, so you couldn't avoid it. And Google figured that not only did they need to do it really cleanly and quickly, but they had to keep people happy. You know, they had to avoid annoying users. So that was important. Doing it a little bit later mattered. Doing it based on this idea of counting incoming links was brilliant. And then they also got lucky by starting late, because by 2000. So many dot-com companies were going out of business, right? So many of the early companies had just burned through their cash, had never come up with a way to make money. And all of a sudden, there was all this surplus equipment around, surplus servers and surplus employees, in fact, and, you know, surplus coders and lots of surplus. And Google still had a big pile of venture capital to deploy. And so it started building its infrastructure and making sure that, you know, everything it kept on its servers was redundant and wouldn't necessarily go down and at a time of intense usage. You know, they invested in bandwidth, fiber optic cable, at a time when it was very cheap to try to make sure that the data flowed well. And so they really took advantage of that time. And the rest of them pretty much all sloughed away except for Yahoo. And then, of course, Microsoft came in a little bit later with its MSN network, which now has teamed up with Yahoo to provide the biggest competitor for Google, which is Bing. But, you know, Google got lucky. It also was smart. It also was fast. It also was dependable. And it was trustworthy. And for all those reasons, you know, in a really short period of time, and this is what fascinated me, why I wrote the book, in a really short period of time, we invited it into so many important areas of our lives for very good reasons. But then, you know, we have to start wondering whether this is how we want to live forever and whether this one company should handle all this kind of stuff.
Right. And, of course, the question is of whether or not we trust Google a bit too much. As you talk about Google and its rapid ascendancy, you write, "Then came Google. Google was clean, it was pure, it was simple." And then you make such an important point. "It accepted no money for ranking one page higher in a search than another. It offered what seemed to be neutral, democratic rankings." I had forgotten until I read those words that once upon a time, the search engines were, in a sense, badly tainted by money.
And not all of them. And it's really hard to actually discern which ones were taking bribes, but some were. And the general perception in the field was that most were. Even today, I get people asking me, "Doesn't Google take money for its placement?" I mean, very few people do, but just enough ask me that I worry about people's general understanding about how search works. Another reason I wrote the book, right? And you know, it really surprised me, because one of the things that set Google apart, and if you were an avid web user and connected to other people who were avid web users or you know, early web designers or people who were into internet culture, one of the first things you heard about Google was that these guys were honest and these guys would not take money for placement, that they wanted to do it scientifically. And that really helped make Google the chosen search engine of the elites. And it didn't take long for the word to spread. Google never had to buy an ad to spread it to, you know, to my mom, but, you know, it didn't take long for my mom to figure out that this was the way, the best and cleanest way to search for the web, through the web. Now, yeah, so that was the case then, and Google now, of course, well, you also have to remember that in the late 90s, no search engine had figured out how to make money. No one had really figured out how to sell ads on the web in a consistent and effective way that would keep advertisers happy and keep them there. It took a long time for anyone to make $1 on the web, and even now, very few companies actually make money on the web per se, right? And, I mean, this year, I think Facebook might finally, you know, make a profit after years of losing money. It took Amazon nearly 4 or 5 years to make its first dollar. But Google figured out in the early part of the 2000s that it could do this really clever ad auction that would present ads that would be really inexpensive for small businesses, could be well-tailored to the search that someone had just made. So, you know, if you're searching for cars, you're going to get ads about cars. And you could actually demonstrate to advertisers that the ad worked, because you could say, look how many people clicked on this ad. You know, the click-through became the thing that Google would charge for, where NBC and CBS would charge by the minute for a time slot and estimate how many people were watching or listening at that moment. You know, just no accountability in that system. It's all faith-based. Google was able to say, look, 500 people clicked through this ad. You know, you should pay for just the clicks, not for the fact that the ad was up there. If it didn't work to pull people through, then we didn't do our jobs. And so Google figured out a really strong way of making revenue fairly early. It's one of the reasons it's such a wealthy company. And so, you know, Google was an important part of showing that somebody could make money on the web. And now the challenge is, of course, that Google has made so much money that a lot of other firms and a lot of other industries worry whether there's any money left for themselves. You know, newspapers wonder whether there's going to be any ad money for them as they try to make more money on the web and put more content on the web. Because if you're an advertiser and your choice is buy an ad in the local newspaper website or buy an ad on Google for the product you're selling, and knowing that Google's going to pretty much localize that ad, only going to show that ad in that area, you know, you're going to be really tempted to go with Google because it's a system you know and you trust and has accountability built in. And that's really created a lot of anxiety. So one of the big things that's changed in recent years is a lot of different players in a lot of different industries have started fearing Google because it does what it does so well.
Mm. And you say Google causes damage mostly by crowding out other alternatives. One of the most interesting moments in your book is when you talk about the term monopoly and whether or not that really is a worthwhile term to be using in this conversation. At one point you write, "It may seem as if I'm arguing that Google is a monopoly and needs to be treated as such, broken up by using the anti-monopoly legislation and regulations developed over the late 19th and early 20th century. But because Google is sui generis, business competition and regulation demand fresh thinking. It's such a new phenomenon that old metaphors and precedents don't fit the challenges the company presents to competitors and users."
Yeah,
that's a really interesting notion. I mean, how do we get ourselves around this issue of what to do with Google if all of the terminology and, for that matter, regulation in place does not seem to especially apply?
Yeah, you know, so one of the ways we often think about our relationship with companies is, you know, we think of ourselves as customers, and I think by default we think of ourselves as Google's customers, right? So Google has about 70% of the search action in the United States. In Western Europe, it's much higher. It's about 90% in most countries, 96% in places like Portugal and Amsterdam. It's the dominant search engine in India right now. It's not anywhere close to being dominant in Russia or China for different reasons. It's not close to being dominant in South Korea or Japan either. But in most of the world, it's the fastest growing search service, and it's clearly dominant even in the U.S. with 70% of the traffic. But that's not what antitrust regulation necessarily has to worry about, because as you may have noticed, you never wrote a check to Google to use it, right? And this creates all sorts of confusion. Anytime someone complains about something that happened on Google or something Google does, you know, often the response is, "Well, what do you expect? Well, how much did you pay for it?" You know, but the fact is, we're not Google's customers, so that's the wrong question to ask. We are the product Google sells to advertisers. The market that Google is in is advertising, and if Google's going to abuse its position, it's going to abuse its position in terms of how it treats advertisers. It's going to exhibit some sort of unfair price policy. It's going to lock out other competitors. It's going to purchase other competitors. And that's kind of what it's been doing. It's been setting minimum bids for its ads in ways that are starting to really annoy some small businesses. It's been downgrading the position of certain firms in the regular search results, which is causing all sorts of anxiety. And actually has sparked an investigation in Western Europe over this practice. And the way it treats companies is really the question that Google's going to have to face in the next few years. And so part of that is not that new, right? Because, you know, NBC and CBS are kind of in the same business. What really matters is how they treat advertisers. But there are other effects, right? Because if there's too much consolidation in the mass media industry, in the broadcast industry, we know it doesn't just affect advertisers. It also affects creators, right? If Comcast buys NBC, the reason that it created so much anxiety and still does, is that Comcast might favor some production over other production to, you know, keep all the money at home. It also might reduce the number of voices active in a democracy. That's a big concern. And so, you know, and it might do some unfavorable picking of winners, some unsavory picking of winners in deciding, you know, which political speech will get out there and which won't. And so those are the variety of things that we all worry about when we talk about a media business being too powerful. And so with Google, it's all a little bit different, right? Because Google's not much of a content provider. It doesn't provide very much content. It does create content like Google Street View. It does create content like in the Books program. But for the most part, Google is offering us content that other people have produced, some of which is good, some of which is bad, some of which is, you know, politically obnoxious, some of which is really edifying, some of which is hate speech, some of which is, you know, sort of pornography, some of it is poetry, right? So, you know, we have a lot of hard questions to ask about the effect that Google's choices and values will play into our way of life. And those are the sorts of questions we should be asking above and beyond the basic antitrust questions, which I think are important but largely have to do with advertising.
Right. You write at one point, if Google is the dominant way we navigate the Internet and thus the primary lens through which we experience both the local and the global, then it has remarkable power to set agendas and alter perceptions. Its biases, for instance, valuing popularity over accuracy, established sites over new, and rough rankings over more fluid or multidimensional models of presentation, are built into its algorithms. And those biases affect how we value things, perceive things, and navigate the worlds of culture and ideas.
Right. So that's the thing, is like when you make an algorithm, and that's Google runs its decision-making based on algorithms. There are no human beings saying, we want, you know, Fred's site in the index, and we want Joe's site out of the index. Occasionally, they have to do that if there's a particularly egregious site that you know perhaps violates a local law. You know, in much of the world, pornography is illegal, and much of the world, hate speech is illegal. So, Google will do that kind of hands-on editing for things that. You know, where the law matters, right? So, and in the U.S., copyright is often the thing that makes Google remove something from the index. But what Google does is it runs these computer algorithms, you know, billions of times per day, really fast, to assess which pages to offer you and which pages to hide. Now, algorithms are not neutral. It's not like looking through a flat plane of glass. You have to embed your chosen values into the algorithms. You have to tell the algorithm what sorts of sites you want to people to see and what sorts of sites you want to hide, you know, relatively. And so every time someone is changing Google's algorithms, and they change almost every month, more and more value decisions are added. And these value decisions are made by people at very high levels at the company, and they talk about it for months before they put it in. But basically, Google is making choices for us, and if we don't understand the nature of those decisions, if we don't understand what Google does favor and why, then we're not going to be able to read Google in an intelligent way. We're not going to be able to understand that, you know, there may be something that Google doesn't present us here because it's not the kind of site Google wants. And it's usually not so nakedly political as we might assume, but often it has to do with sort of the style of page design or the origin of the page. And there are very good reasons for that most of the time, but we should also, you know, just understand that Google's not giving us everything. Its job is actually to do the opposite. Its job is to hide things from us so we're not driven crazy by the, you know, by the choices in abundance. And, you know, as I said, if you understand how Google works and you have a good sense that what Google is doing for us is for the most part beneficial, then fine. You know, let's keep using Google as we do, but let's do it in an aware way. But I'm worried that Google is making changes these days, and Google is shifting the values that it embeds into these algorithms to favor consumerism, to favor shopping. And that's necessarily bad for learning, right? You can't have a system that gets better and better at helping people shop and expose and still hope that it's going to serve our needs as citizens, as students, as scholars, as journalists, as researchers, mm-hmm. and as curious people. And people want to settle bar bets in sports bar bets, right? I think we've had a really good run for a decade or more using this one service to facilitate our shopping desires and our learning desires. But I think that those two fields are diverging, and I think we might have to ask some hard questions about how well Google's going to serve us in terms of learning in the future.
Hmm. You actually, towards that end, talk about some of the other search engines that have recently sprung up, which are seeking to do an even better job of facilitating our searches, or maybe doing a better job of facilitating a certain kind of really serious kind of inquiry. Although you tell us that none of these have made serious, you know, inroads or penetration into Google's market. But the fact that there are people out there making the attempt says something about how important this is. Can you just say a word about the possibility of this matter of the search being done differently, and at least for certain kinds of searches being done even better than Google's doing it?
Yeah, you know, I'm fairly sure that people are working on better algorithms all the time, and I know that there have been a good number of experiments and attempts by small companies to run out better search engines than Google offers, at least better for something, right? You always have to remember that not every search engine is good for everything, right? So there are certain search engines that are specifically for medical searches, other search engines that are specifically designed for academic work, other search engines that are specifically designed for statistical work, and each of these is a neat and helpful experiment, but the chances of any of them displacing Google or erasing some of Google's advantage are very slim for a couple of reasons. One thing we have to remember is that, remember I talked about how in 2000, 2001, Google had all this ability to invest in infrastructure. Google has much more going for it than smart people and smart code. It has a tremendous amount of sunken glass and steel and bricks in server farms all over the Pacific Northwest, in actual, computers and servers and bandwidth. And so it's almost impossible to imagine a small startup coming anywhere close to that sort of infrastructure. And it's that infrastructure that makes Google work as well as it does, because Google's able to crunch so much information so quickly and so subtly that you're going to, any new attempt at creating a search engine is only going to be able to deal with marginal searches. You know, it's not going to be able to handle the sort of traffic, the millions of people trying to search at the same time that Google does. So that's one thing to remember. The other thing is that often when people come up with a really cool search technology, Google's right there to purchase it, or Microsoft is to purchase it, right? So we often don't even hear about the best moves in search, because one of these two big companies will buy up a company to get their employees and their code, the same way that Google bought up YouTube. You know, Google tried to launch Google Video, and no one cared. It just wasn't easy to use. It wasn't fun. It was actually kind of staid and boring, and it wasn't getting anywhere. You know, and here was big bad Google just not capturing people's imaginations. And these, a couple of guys started up YouTube with some pretty basic technology, and they were pretty soon overwhelmed. Their infrastructure was overwhelmed by demand. Fortunately, Google came in and rescued them. Lost a tremendous amount of money on YouTube. It's never really made money, but nonetheless, it was important for Google to have this rather than to have someone else have this. I don't think that we can realistically expect any company except Microsoft to compete with Google in terms of search. And even then, Microsoft's chosen only to compete in the consumerist way. You know, the Bing search engine is explicitly about buying. It's not at all about, you know, no, there's no ad for Bing that says, are you curious about that pain in your knee? You know, use Bing. It's about, you know, do you want to buy an airline ticket, or do you want to decide where to go to dinner? Those are the things you use Bing for. So as Bing makes itself more prominent, Google reacts by making itself better for shopping as well.
I was fascinated by your point that Google, in undertaking its gigantic Google Books project of essentially scanning and preserving all printed books, that it is not just for the sake of that, but it is because in doing so, it is going to ultimately be able to vastly improve and make more sophisticated its search engine, that capacity.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the holy grail of search is semantic search. To be able to give people what they want in their own language. So, you know, right now, if you go to Google and you type in, what is the capital of Idaho, the first link will be the answer, Boise, and then there will be a Wikipedia link about Boise, and then there will be probably the official Boise city site, maybe the Boise Chamber of Commerce. Well, how did Google know to answer your question, what is the capital of Idaho, right? And the reason is that Google right now sort of fakes thought. It understands that lots of people type that question in, and over time it's learned that when people type that question in, they tended to click on the link for Boise. So they've created a shortcut that says, okay, if someone types in a what is question, chances are they're looking for a particular fact, and they do this sort of pattern recognition. But that's not actually how minds think, and it's not how language works. They're just faking it mathematically. But what Google would love to do, what every search company would love to do, what every computer scientist would love to do, is create an ability for computers to answer every kind of question, right? So, you know, what is the best fish taco restaurant in Austin, Texas? If you want to type that in, right now you're looking for pages that actually have that string of text on it, and Google's not likely to be able to answer that question. And it's so having a tremendous amount of information, tremendous amount of syntax, the way that sentences work. You know, to have all that in Google's computers means that Google can then do high-level mathematical analysis of the dynamics of sentences, and they can hopefully understand how sentences actually work. Which is why, right now, one of the most exciting intellectual fields in the world is this intersection between linguistics and computer science, because, you know, scientists are trying to figure out ways to get computers to understand actual human language, and not just English, right? And that's why Google wants all these books in all these different languages, to be able to understand over time and over space how languages work and how sentences work. And when they can do that, they're, you know, two or three steps closer to semantic search. And that, you know, that's a pretty exciting prospect. So that really explains why Google's interested in having just so much stuff from us, so much text, so much voice contact, so it can really mine and understand how we use language in general.
And of course, it will come to, in a sense, understand us even better. And one of the points of your book is that we need to try to understand Google at least as well as it understands us. At one point, you write, Google is a black box. It knows a tremendous amount about us, and we know far too little about it. But that changes once we read the Googleization of everything. At least it's a start. And the book, once again, is published by the University of California Press, and its author, Professor Siva Vaidyanathan. I really appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this fascinating topic. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will preview for you a fascinating American Experience documentary airing tomorrow night on PBS called Klansville, USA, which examines when and why and how the Ku Klux Klan resurged so dramatically in the state of North Carolina during the 1960s. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as